Hello and welcome to On the Mat on Radio Australia. I'm Barry Clark. December the 1st was World AIDS Day, and in this edition of the program, we reflect on the impact of HIV/AIDS on women in particular. Shortly in the program, we'll hear from Maura May from Papua New Guinea. Maura's moving personal story is balanced by the work she does as an advocacy officer across government, NGOs and the private sector. First, though, let's hear from Mary Robinson. Mary Robinson is a well-known international figure. She was the first woman president of Ireland, and for 5 years she served as UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. Mary Robinson is patron of the international community of women living with HIV/AIDS.
What has struck me again and again is that women bear so much of the burden of HIV. If it's the husband or father or brother who is infected, it's the woman who tends to be the caregiver, as wife, as sister, as mother, and she bears that burden. If we look at the whole issue of poverty, women already are coping and struggling in circumstances of poverty. But they are discriminated against in their rights. They don't have land rights. They don't have inheritance rights. All too often, women tell me, you know, when I was found to be positive, I was blamed. I was the one who lost the home and had to leave with the children. It was my husband's brother, when he died, who came and took my home from me. Over and over again, core problems of the lack of empowerment and status. And in particular, I've been very worried and concerned about young girls. Why is it that the figures, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, are so high for young girls' infection? Young girls are not bad. They are just without power in this power environment. And they have to cope and they have to survive, basically. And it's those incredible stories of survival, sex survival, needing the relationship with the older man, an uncle having sex because he believes it might cure him if he has sex with a virgin, and all these stories that are so true because you hear them repeated over and over again. And then nobody's listening. Nobody's listening to young adolescent girls as to what they have to go through and the multiple discriminations. First of all, just because they're a girl. And then, if they happen to become positive, their whole lives. And nobody understands what it's like for a 16 or 17-year-old. And I've been privileged to sit in some groups that the YWCA have organised where these girls get space to talk to each other. And I've been privileged just to be there listening quietly and hearing the pain and the frustration and the anger and the, you know, how do we cope? Who are we? How can we do this? You know, how can this be done to us, basically? Why are my brothers more important than I am? Why do they have so much more freedom? Does nobody hear my voice?
Mary Robinson, patron of the international community of women living with HIV/AIDS. Well, as Mary said, does nobody hear my voice? We're fortunate today to hear from Maura May from Papua New Guinea. Maura is a nurse working for Australian Aid. She works as a GIPA advocacy officer. Now, GIPA is an acronym for Greater Involvement of People Living with HIV. Maura's role is to work across government, NGOs, the private and business sectors, indeed anyone involved in working with HIV/AIDS. Her aim is to get them to involve HIV-positive people meaningfully in their programs, and not just because they are HIV-positive. Maura May is talking to Alice Wellborn.
The meaningful involvement of positive people is important at this level because, you know, we want to also contribute to policies that affect our lives. Policies like the criminalization policy. How can we meaningfully contribute? So in a way that positive people can have their say and share their experiences, and from this the policies can be made in a way that they're not stigmatizing or harmful to positive people, but can benefit them as well as the whole public.
Would you like to begin by telling us when you first learned that you have HIV?
When I first learned it, you know, I was positive. I was so scared. And being a nurse, like I was taught at school that in college that, you know, once you have HIV, that's the end of it. You don't, there's no medication to treat it. So when I got my diagnosis, it was like, okay, I'm positive, I'm going to die tomorrow. I was diagnosed because I was pregnant with my first baby. And when I went to the antenatal clinic, as part of their routine testing, they didn't inform me that they were going to test my blood for HIV. It was in 1997. The antenatal clinic was within the main city, Port Moresby. None of the staff knew me, but we didn't have HIV services as well during that time. They referred me to the doctor to tell me the result. So when I walked in, he told me, like, just point blank, that we tested your blood for HIV and it's positive. And I told him, no, that's not my blood, you are lying. And he said, okay, we are going to do a second confirmation test. And the nurses were, it was horrible. Like, they saw me as if I was some kind of infectious, you know. You know, they didn't see me as a person.
So what did you do next, Mara, once they had confirmed your diagnosis?
There was no support in place, nothing. I just went home and waited for the day I'll die. They told me that there was a social worker who was coming to visit me to talk about HIV and my baby and, you know, all these issues. I waited and I waited and I waited. Throughout that 9 months of my pregnancy, no social worker came. After I delivered, no social worker came. When I was in the postnatal ward, no social worker came until I went home. I didn't receive any counseling whatsoever.
And how is your baby's health?
My baby was okay up until 3 months. I had to go to work. So I left my baby with the grandmother, my husband's mother. And when I came back, she wasn't looking after her well. And she got some breathing problems. I brought her to the clinic, emergency ward, and the doctors got the card, and when they saw the front of the card, the summary, it said that her mother is HIV positive, and they totally refused to treat my baby. And we just sat there until the next morning she died. When my baby died, I was angry. I was especially angry at the nurses. I was angry at my husband. I was angry at everybody. I kind of shut myself away from the world, the community activities, whatever was going on. And I concentrated on my work. But I couldn't, you know, concentrate on my work, so I had to resign. I stayed at home. I just went into some kind of experience where I just withdrew myself from the world and I was kind of living in, say, a world of fantasy or something like that. And it made me to write down my thoughts on a book. So I started writing poetry and I produced a book, my first book on poetry, during that stage of, you know, when I was looking at the world, I saw how people were, you know, what was going around me, the violence and, you know, all that stuff. And I said, this is wrong. So the first thing I did was I wrote my first book of poetry. When I published this book, that was the same year that I disclosed my status. It was in 2001.
How did your family react to your news?
I first broke the news to my mother and she was like crying and she was so sad and she said, don't worry, you're not gonna die, you'll be okay, we'll look after you. When I told my brother and his wife, they told me, oh, we already knew. And I said, how did you know? And they told me, you remember that time you were sick and you were in the hospital and we went to visit you, the nurses told us that you had HIV.
And how did you feel about that?
I was so angry. I felt that it was unfair. And, you know, I just thought to myself, this is not right.
So what would you like to say to ministries of health when health staff treat people like this in different parts of the world?
I would like to call upon the health, you know, ministries and health departments in each country that, you know, nurses and doctors, once they graduate from their colleges or universities, they make an oath that they will serve people and keep confidentiality. Whatever they do in medical setting is for the setting. And I don't understand it. As a nurse, when they breach those, you know, laws, is there some kind of penalties for it? Or is there some way that the health ministries or health departments throughout the world can deal with this kind of issue?
Maura May from Papua New Guinea. Maura is talking with Alice Wellborn from a UK-based NGO, Strategies for Hope. The organisation's aim is to promote positive thinking and practical action in the field of HIV/AIDS care, support and prevention. Alice Wellborn asked Maura May what she thinks about the policy of antenatal testing that's being introduced in some countries.
I hate that policy. Because in Papua New Guinea right now, they're rolling out this provider-initiated counselling and testing, and it's a nightmare, I'll say. I argued with the health ministries in PNG, as well as the WHO, and I told them, you know, they're doing routine testing for women and group counselling, but some of those women can't, you know, they are not giving them the option to opt out. And it's like, the kind of counselling that they're giving them is not right. It's kind of very judgmental and criticising them and all that stuff. And then they put all the women through to get tested for HIV, which some are not consenting to it, but they just test them anyway. From my own experience, when I was, you know, diagnosed and tested and got the result as being positive, I just wanted to put an end to everything, and I was worried about the baby, and I was worried about myself, and, you know, what's going to happen, and all these things. And it affected me psychologically. I couldn't concentrate. I didn't eat properly, and I was getting sick.
In many parts of the world now, there is a move to criminalise transmission of HIV. Is this happening in the Pacific Islands also?
The criminalisation of transmission, I feel that it's not right. And because during my experiences, they made me feel guilty, they made me feel that, you know, I had no right to become pregnant, and, you know, what will happen to this baby if I infect him or her with HIV? You know, how would I cope with that? And it was all these things that, they were very cruel to me, the way they said. And it made me, and, you know, psychologically, I became more depressed. I've decided to do this interview because I know that there are many millions of women out there who are going through the same experience that I've been through. And some are not talking about it. And we need to talk about it in order to change for a better world tomorrow, and for the women of today to, you know, have the right to have families, especially being pregnant and the joy of having a baby. Other people just tend to, you know, think that this is not right, but it's part of our right to have, you know, families and children. So I'm doing this not because I want to do it, but because of how many millions of women are out there going through this situation, and also to alert the health ministries and departments right across the world that, you know, to look into what the nurses are doing at the antenatal clinics and postnatal clinics, about the kind of care they give, the kind of, you know, treatment that they give, and the support that they are giving to pregnant women. And I hope that there will be changes out of this interview, that the health ministries or people who are in charge of looking at, you know, pediatric and antenatal guidelines will take this into consideration.
Maura May from Papua New Guinea, and she was talking with Alice Wellborn. And you can hear more of Maura's story, along with a number of other women from around the world who were interviewed for Strategies for Hope, at their website at www.stratshope.org. This is On the Mat on Radio Australia, and finally in today's edition, we hear from Dr. Musimbi Kanyoro. Musimbi is a Kenyan based in the US and has worked with HIV-positive women since the beginning of the epidemic in Africa. She also spoke to Alice Wellborn for the NGO Strategies for Hope.
Could we perhaps go back to Kenya for a minute and think about how you have seen HIV affecting women whom you know?
There was a time when I was really afraid that there was not enough attention by the government on HIV. But in about 5 years ago, I really saw a strong attention from every group. I could see everywhere that you traveled, you could see notices about prevention. You could see words such as use condoms, which in the beginning wasn't. In the early years, I could see church leaders, for example, banning condoms and telling people that they must not listen to those stories. But I think people, in the end, trusted their own instinct of what they need to do. And right now, when I go, and even in my village where I come from, where my parents lived, I don't find anyone who doesn't really know something about HIV. They might not have all the facts correct, but they know about the illness. Often they might know someone who has been openly verbal about being HIV positive. I can't give any statistics anymore other than what I read from other publications. I think women in the rural areas still need a lot of support. They really still need a lot of support. Sometimes I travel from Nairobi, which is well equipped with what people can get in some areas, and then I just move into a less affluent part of Nairobi, a place that is struggling more, and I find that even if they have some information, there is so much else that is on their mind that they don't put it as the most important. I've had people tell me when I visit, especially in the slum part of Nairobi, if I don't die from HIV, I will die from something else. I can die from being knocked down, or a car, or I can slip down, or hunger, or stabbed. So I think people do know about HIV in some ways, but they don't let it occupy themselves. I took a group of business women to visit Kenya. Many of them were from the United States, but Mary Robinson was with me, and we went into real poor areas of Nairobi, wanting just to hear the experience about HIV. We visited also positive women's organizations in these areas, and the positive women's organizations were doing tremendous work of having women come to the center and giving them the support and leading them to where they could get the support, and that was very impressive. But let what I've said about rural women or women who are living in poor economic areas like the slums of Nairobi not be seen as if HIV doesn't affect other women. Almost everyone is affected. There is a difference, though, in terms of access to information between women who have had an education and women who are professional, because they may be able to access information and do something and get on ARV. But despite all of this, when it comes to violence against women, every woman is almost affected. And sometimes even professional women, if they are HIV positive, could face quite some disadvantages and especially stigmatization. And probably I sometimes think that professional women and educated women suffer a lot more from stigmatization because of protecting the status quo of what they have achieved in life than even rural women who might be more concerned about day-to-day things. I wanted to give an example of a friend of mine who is a nurse, and her husband died from HIV. He did not become ill. He just died very strong, and we don't really know what happened. And then she went and did the test after her husband died and found that she was positive. And just the possibility to share with just friends and say this had happened to her was the most difficult for her, or even members of the families, because they had been on very high economic status and social status also within the society, and it was really quite difficult for her.
One of the areas that you know that I'm particularly concerned about is antenatal testing.
The trouble with antenatal testing is that it's at a time when a woman is most vulnerable. She's expecting a baby, and she has so much to deal with, both in her physique and in her own psychology. But for me, as an African woman, I always get defeated by knowing that women have very little access to health facilities and to health centers. And sometimes the only time that a woman goes to a health facility is when there's something that is beyond her. Women won't go because they have headache. They'll have a backache, and it might be something serious, but they still won't go. But they know that that baby's going to need to come out, so they go because they care for the other person that they are carrying. If there was a good supportive system, sufficiently confidential, I would prefer that they get tested at that time, because it helps to also develop ways in which they can be a support to protect the child from becoming infected. Because if they are not tested at that time, she is in danger and the baby is in danger. What I have not liked about the methods that have been used is sometimes when the tests are done, women are used as statistics, which are recorded, and no direct help is given to them. Sometimes there's then attention to only the child. Every child needs a mother. I have written and spoken about this very loudly in many different forums, that if we want to treat the children and protect them from HIV infection, we must focus the mother as well. And then the third area, which is important for me, is that she gets confidential support on how such information is managed. She has to be the central person managing that information with support from somewhere else, because some women at that particular time may not even have a place to go because they are particular homes, married or otherwise, or relationships may simply reject them. So here you have a woman expecting and she's rejected. But I personally believe there is a possibility in antenatal testing, and what we should be campaigning is that they become woman-friendly, woman-sensitive, and that they are called the woman and the baby to be both the help they need.
Dr. Musimbi Kanyoro was talking to Alice Wellborn from Strategies for Hope. Just a reminder of their website at www.stratshope.org for more stories on women and HIV/AIDS. And on Radio Australia and on the mat for today, it's goodbye from me, Barry Clark.